This is an interview with Ted Kaufman for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. I'm James Stoker. Today is August 29th, 2012. We're talking in downtown Wilmington, Delaware. Senator Kaufman, thanks very much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
First, to start out, why don't you tell me a little bit about your background? Where were you born and where did you grow up?
Sure, I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and that's where I grew up. My father was a Deputy Commissioner of Public Welfare. He was a social worker. My mother was a teacher. I had three wonderful sisters. I went to school in Philadelphia through high school. I went to Central High School in Philadelphia, and then went to Duke University and got a Bachelor's of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering.
Okay, while you were at Duke, did you study any business or finance?
I studied no business or finance. Back then, the engineering program was such you didn't get a whole lot of choices outside of engineering, and that really business was not my interest. No one in my family had ever been involved in business, but what happened is after I left Duke, I went to work for the American Standard Industrial Division. I was basically what then was called a sales engineer. I was an engineer, used to work with consultants and consulting engineers and architects and big power plant companies, and I would provide the equipment, so we had to design the equipment for the specific jobs. And
about what time was this?
I graduated from Duke in 1960. I went to Detroit for 6 months for a training program, and then came back to Charlotte, North Carolina, where I worked there for 2 years, and then 2 years in my own office in Raleigh, calling on these folks. And what happened was, after spending 4 years, I didn't even take 4 years, but like maybe after a year and a half or 2 years, I said, this business stuff is really fascinating, and I really don't know anything about it. I mean, no one in my background was a business person, none of my family. So I said, I want to go back and get an MBA. And then what happened was that I was living in Raleigh, two children, married with two children, and I said, well, there's a program at the University of North Carolina. We can go back for 1 year. I had a company car. I had two cars. I had a company car. I could have kept my company car. I could have gone back to work for after I got out of it. So I applied to the University of North Carolina, and then I thought, well, everybody in my family had gone to the University of Pennsylvania. Literally everybody, my parents, my sisters, everybody had a Penn degree except me. And so I said, well, you know, maybe I'd apply to Wharton. And I applied to Wharton, and then I got in. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like the old road not traveled. If I don't go to Wharton, well, I regret it. And I went to Wharton, and it was just an incredible experience. And that's really where I got interested in business.
Tell me about your studies there. What sorts of subjects did you study? What sorts of
I did the whole full Monte. I majored in marketing because that's what I'd done. But I took all the really tough finance courses. Not all, but a number of the really tough finance courses. I did administration, I did manufacturing, operations research. Essentially, I jammed into those 2 years a lot of courses. And the interesting thing was, I never missed a class because I said it's like people in the front are giving out dollar bills. I mean, I took the investment courses, that's where I learned a lot about investments. It was just a great experience. While I had not done well in undergraduate school, I learned a lot of other things. At Wharton, I did very, very well.
Did you go to Wharton with an idea in mind of what you'd be doing afterwards?
Not really. What I went to Wharton was, I say to people, you go to business school, law school is different. You come and they'll teach you a bunch of things, and same thing with engineering. But in business school, you really have to come, I think, with a bunch of questions. That's why it's important to work before you went back. I'd worked for 5 years before I went back. So I literally showed up at Wharton with 500 questions about how do you do this and why do you do that and why do people do this and shouldn't the companies do this or shouldn't what's the market work on this or how does this work? So I came up with those questions and literally went to class searching for the answers to these questions. And every day it was just a wonderful thing. I used to get up in the morning just as I was working, and I'd get on the train to go into town. Into Wharton, and I get in there like at 8 o'clock or something like that. And regardless of what classes I had, I'd stay there till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I loved it, and I learned a lot. And I've said many, many times to people, there's a lot of emphasis at schools like Wharton on making contacts and for the future and the rest of it. I said early on, and it's even truer today, I said, if you gave me a choice, I had to choose between a Wharton education or the Wharton contacts, it'd be the easiest decision I ever made. The Wharton education was the people I was exposed to, the teachers. I'm talking about teachers. It was a great experience. Mm-hmm.
You said you took courses on finance there. Yeah. Did you also study financial regulation, how the SEC works?
No. None of the government side of there wasn't. As I remember, there were no courses. There wasn't a whole lot of interest. You got to remember what it was like back then. There just wasn't much interest. Government was not the factor that it's become now. So there was no interest in that. There's a Fellows School of Public Administration there, and I recommend a lot of people go there later on in my career. But back then, I don't even think Fellows was in existence, and there was no real courses on federal regulation.
What did you do after you left Wharton?
I went to work. I went to work for the DuPont Company in Wilmington, Delaware. I decided I didn't want to do management consulting. I really wanted to get into it because, again, I was interested in business and building a career. I didn't want to do investment banking. I didn't want to move the family to New York. That's the biggest thing. I want to avoid the commute, which is ironic based on the fact that I commuted so much to Washington later on. And Wilmington was great. I literally could the distance from my home. I worked at the Chestnut Run Technical Services Laboratory. It was 10 minutes from work, so I would come in and do that. But the reason I picked DuPont is because I wanted to be a significant player in corporate America, and I wanted to and I want to be prepared if, in fact, ever that opportunity presented itself. So I wanted to go to work for a company where you could learn all the different, learn about manufacturing, learn about marketing, learn about finance, learn about research, learn about all those things. And DuPont really was the kind of company that was structured so you could do that. My final choice came down to IBM and DuPont. I loved IBM. People were great. But basically at IBM, you spent your whole career in marketing. You could rise up to practically CEO and never have any manufacturing finance.
Now, you also mentioned to me earlier that you were trading stocks during this period yourself, right?
Yeah, no, when I got out of Wharton, I was trading stocks. I was working for DuPont right after I got out. After I've been there for, I was in Wilmington for a year, then I moved to Boston, then I moved for a year, then I moved to Los Angeles for a year. Basically what was known then as a technical representative, again, dealing with engineering products, engineering plastics in this case, with everybody from Polaroid to Mattel and the automobile companies. But when I came back, I was assigned to financial analysis. And during that period, when I was in financial analysis, those 2 years, I really got heavily into investing. In fact, one of my best lessons, I learned so much from investing. I remember the first time I invested in a stock that didn't turn out well, and I was talking to my broker, and I said, I lost like $500, which then back then for me was a lot of money. And he said, well, just mark it up to tuition. And it was the best, smartest thing he ever said. Investing was all about learning how to do it, and I'll never forget I learned about leverage in a real solid way, and that was there was a company called Pennzoil United, and they had I think it was convertible or something, but anyway it fell under the category of bonds that you only had to put up 10% margin. So I went out and I bought $100,000 worth of Pennzoil with $10,000. I had a little money that my wife had inherited. I didn't have much. And I put in Pennzoil United because I thought this was a really safe deal and I could make a lot of money. It went to 110. I bought it at 100, but $100,000 worth, which is $10,000. It went to 110. I doubled my money. Well, what happened was like early 70s, and the bond market went to hell. And Pennzoil every day was going down a quarter point, a half a point. And what happened then is you have margin calls. And they'd call me up and they'd say, okay, Kaufman, we need another $500,000. And I was coming with margin calls. I'll never forget, it went to 87. I now had $23,000 in this thing. and I was at 3 o'clock in the morning staring at the ceiling. And, you know, there's no way you can learn about leverage better than go. I mean, that was the best thing that ever happened. And then, and fortunately, eventually it stopped and turned around, and I eventually sold the stock for essentially what I bought it for. But that sears into your mind why leverage is dangerous and why there are no low return, that return and risk are directly proportional. You can't have, if you have low risk, you're going to get low return. If you have high risk, if you have a high return, you're going to have high risk.
Okay. So how did you come to join Senator Joe Biden's staff?
Well, I joined Joe Biden before there was a staff. Essentially, I was working in financial analysis, as I said, and then I went to work at on the development of Corian. I worked in research and development on the development of Corian, which is the synthetic marble type substance that people use in bathrooms, and it was experimental, and then it went to commercial. Anyway, during that period, I had some extra time, and I decided I'd get a little bit involved in politics. Both my parents were strong Democrats. My mother was a very strong committee person, Democratic committee person. So I figured I'd get involved in politics. So I kind of went down to my local Democratic Party and signed up, and I went through a whole process there. And then through that process, I met Joe Biden and his family. And then in June of that year, I'd worked very hard on helping get a governor the nomination in the ultimate election. And that was over in June because the incumbent Republican governor was in deep trouble because of financial crisis. And so in June, Joe Biden's sister, Valerie, who ran his campaign, called me and said, "Ted, I know you're not working on that gubernatorial campaign anymore. That's pretty much over. Would you consider working for my brother?" And I said, "Sure." And she said, "Well, why don't you come down and we'll meet and talk to us?" So I went down with Valerie and I met with Joe Biden, candidate for the Senate. And I said, absolutely, I'd help him. And the reason I'd help him is because he was really ahead of his time in a lot of issues that I really cared about, the environment. No one was talking about the environment. He was talking about the environment. He was talking about how we should have balanced budgets. No Democrats were talking about balanced budgets back then. He was opposed to the war. We should get out of the war. But he didn't make it, you know, like a cause.
Was this in 1974 or was this before?
72.
72, okay.
This literally June of 72.
Okay.
And he also was one of the first Democrats to talk about the fact that the people that got hurt most by crime were our people and that we should have a tough criminal justice system. A whole bunch of issues like that. He really was. But he was 29 years old, and he looked every bit 29 years old. He was running against the one of the beloved elected officials in the history of Delaware, Senator Caleb Boggs. Senator Boggs had been a congressperson, then he'd been a governor, and now he was the incumbent senator. He was known and loved by everyone, and Joe Biden was running. He was 29 years old. On top of that, to make it even worse, it was an election where McGovern was the top of the Democratic ticket, Nixon was the top of the Republican ticket. It was just, and so I told him in June of 1972, I said, "Joe, I'll work for you, but I think there's absolutely positively no chance you can ever win." And I mean, the fact that a 29-year-old got the nomination is an indication. I think he turned out to be the second, third, or fourth youngest person ever elected to the Senate running against Cale Boggs. And sure enough, he got elected. And I will never forget, it was one of the, in a lot of different ways, it was momentous. But the most momentous thing about it was I can remember being in the Gold Ballroom at the Hotel DuPont, not far from where we're doing this taping, that night, and when they announced he won, I thought, I will never again believe anything's impossible. I mean, he had 19% of the vote on Labor Day. They did a survey, a big survey. He had 19% of the vote against Boggs on Labor Day. So he won. I can remember at the Gold Ballroom, nobody knew what kind of staff he had. Nobody knew anything about it. I surely was not going to work for him. I mean, I was on working for DuPont in a career, and not I wasn't going to work for him. Well, then, as you know, probably know, or maybe don't know, September that was Election Day. On December the 18th, his wife, he was married to Amelia. His wife, Nelia, and he had two sons, Bo and Hunt, and a daughter, Naomi, and he was in Washington, and Neil was bringing home the Christmas tree and got hit by a tractor trailer. She was killed, his daughter was killed, and Bowen Hunt were put in the hospital. He went through a period where it's in all the books where he said, and I can genuinely tell you the truth, I mean, he was really blown away. I mean, totally, completely blown away. And he and Neil were real, you know, there are couples that are tight, and there's couples that are tight, and there's couples that are tight. They were really a very close couple. And for a long time, he said he wasn't going to serve, that he needed his kids, needed him more. And so when he made the base, thanks to Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, Fritz Hollings, a senator from South Carolina, Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts, Hubert Humphrey from Minnesota, they really did kind of rally around him. Robert Byrd came up to the memorial service, stood in the back, never said a word to anybody. A whole bunch of senators really kind of took him under their wing and encouraged him. And Mansell's argument was basically, look, try it for 6 months. If you don't like it, if you can't do it. And so he did it. And so in January, really early in January, Valerie called me again. Valerie said, you know, he called me. Valerie said he was there, and Valerie told him to do it. He said, call me. And he said, Ted, I want to talk to you about coming to work for me and my staff. And I said, I'll talk to you, but I don't see how that could work. And so I went and talked to him, and he said, his basic argument was, look, I want to put a lot of my staff in Delaware, in fact, half my staff. Back then, I think that the two senators and the congressman from Delaware had like two people total in the staff. Mm-hmm. But we'd started to get fax machines, they were pretty elemental. But so we're going to do our mail back and forth. So he said, what I'd like you to do is take half the staff and put them in Delaware, and I'd like you to run them, and I'd like you to represent me in the staff. And if you just do it for a year to get me started. So I went to the people that I worked for in DuPont, and I said, can I get a one-year leave of absence? They said, sure, we'll give you a one-year of absence. So I took a one-year of absence, and that's how. And the rest is, as they say, is history.
All right. So at this time, Delaware, well, obviously still today, Delaware was known as a center for banks and corporations. Sure. Do you think these organizations had any influence on Senator Biden's positions on financial issues?
Not really. I think, because remember, when I was a senator, let me just tell you my story, my personal story, and that is, credit cards. You know, I mean, Delaware, major private supplier is credit cards. And I forget how many employees work here in the state. It's a big number. It's less than what it used to be, but it's a big number. And so when I got to be a senator, there was this major credit card reform bill. And here I am sitting here with 20-some thousand credit card employees. And so this is the thing I spent a lot of time talking about, lecturing about when I was at teaching at Duke Law School for 20 years. I talked to the students about the conflicts that you face as a member of Congress. And one of them is kind of, you know, the old Edmund Burke state charge that we should worry about the national interest, not about our local interest. But there's a conflict between your national interest and local interest. So I'm sitting there, but here's something that's very important to a number of people in Delaware. Fortunately for me, there was the Fed came out with a study, there was a compromise made, everybody voted for it, it wasn't a problem. But just to give you some flavor for how I think this works and how it worked for these, you do worry about what state you represent. But, for instance, the credit card thing. We had 20-some thousand people that worked in the credit card industry. But we had 600,000 people that had credit cards. So it's not, people want to make it a very simple kind of decision. It's not a simple decision. But I remember there was something had to do with, you know, I pretty much voted against the banks, against the credit card industries, and when I was in the Senate, because I thought it was in the best interest of the people of Delaware and the nation. I never felt like there was a conflict there. But there was an issue where it was generally believed, I can't remember, it was some amendment to something, and because I was that position, a reporter from one of the papers, smart guy, came to me and said, well, Kaufman, you're just like the rest of them. Here's this bill, and it's to help Delaware, and you voted for it. And I said to him, I said, you look at my name in the paper? You know, it says Ted Kaufman, D. Delaware. I mean, I do have every member of Congress has a responsibility to represent the state that they come from. Now, it's a very difficult conflict between representing the state you come from and representing the national interest. So the idea that I would vote for Delaware on a particular issue is, that's the way it should be. As I say, we're not the only person that's elected at large is the President of the United States. Every member of Congress has a responsibility to their home district and responsible to the national district, and dealing with that can be very difficult. But fortunately, me, the 2 years I'm in the Senate, it was very easy. There weren't any real major, conflicts between representing the people of Delaware and representing the country.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you talked just now about your experience as a senator. I want to ask you again about your experience as a staff member, because
sure.
We've got a lot of questions
Absolutely,
for you
yeah.
about your Senate experience yeah. later. While you were a staff member, did you have any contacts with the Securities and Exchange Commission at all? Did you know much about the organization?
No. And I think, again, let me just put into context. I'll talk about when I was a staff member, but also as a senator. What happened when I became a senator? I sat down with some people I really respect, and we said, okay, you know, what am I going to do while I'm here? I'm working MBA, you know, what do? You sit down, you plan goals and objectives and strategies and all that kind of stuff. So you put all this stuff together. And we basically decided the best thing for me to do, since I was only going to be there for 2 years, was that I should deal in the same areas that I was familiar with after 22 years working for Senator Biden. And those primarily were the Judiciary Committee and the Foreign Relations Committee. Because Woodrow Wilson said, Congress and committee is Congress at work. So the most important thing, especially back when I first started as a staff person, you can only operate on your committees. It turned out that the Senate had really changed, and I didn't really focus on that. But I said, look, you know, I'm really familiar with the Judiciary Committee issues because I worked on them for so long. And I'm really familiar with foreign policy issues because I worked on them so long. So the easiest way, 2 years, rather than taking like the Commerce Committee and having to get up to speed on a whole new set of issues, these are the issues that I should take. And it worked out, and I asked Harry Reid for that, and Harry Reid gave me those two committees. Well, when I was working for Senator Biden, he was not totally interested in any of the finance issues. That wasn't his background. I did some regulatory things, but most of the issues that I dealt with the commercial issues on judiciary, because that was an area that of his expertise. So he kind of delegated covering that as a staff person. But I didn't really. I'm hard pressed to think of a regulatory issue that I dealt with, and I'm hard pressed to think of a financial issue or a Wall Street issue. It was really kind of fascinating that. When I got there, I think it was really the same thing to do. But I spent a lot of time in the Senate dealing with the fact that I was an engineer, which Senator Biden wasn't. Got very involved in science, technology, engineering, and math, and education, all that. And I got very involved in the financial area because that was my education, my background, experience.
What about say the SNL crisis? Do you recall being?
Yeah, no, the SNL crisis. We were primarily concerned about putting people in jail. We were more involved in the financial. Fraud and the rest of that, which I got very involved in the Senate. I was very involved during the trying to figure out how we can put some of these people in jail that committed fraud during the latest crisis. But no, during SNL, it was all about, wasn't about the financial side of it. It was totally about people committing fraud. It was basically Judiciary Committee issues.
Okay. So what year did you leave Senator Biden's staff?
In 1995.
Okay.
I decided... that time I was 55 years old, and I said, I don't want to ever retire, so what I want to do, and you can't work the rest of your life as chief of staff to a United States senator, which is a 65-hour-a-week backbreaking job. So I said, I want to get into something else, and so I left Senator Biden's office in
And what did you do?
1995. In 1991, I'd started teaching at the Duke Law School. I taught a course in the Congress.
On business in the Congress, right?
Huh?
Was the course on the Congress itself or on business in the Congress?
No, the first course, the course I started with was on the Congress. A fellow named Chris Schrader, who's a professor at Duke, came and asked me to teach it with him. I got to meet him during the Bork nomination. He had been hired by us to come up and help with the constitutional issues on the board. So I went to work for that in 1991. And I'd done it thinking that I'm going to retire, I'm going to leave Senator Biden's office at some point, and I want to do things, and teaching would be great. So what happened? 1991, I started teaching a course in the Congress with Chris Schrader for law students, and my office was actually in the law school, law students and public policy students. So it was half the class was law students, half were public policy students. Most of the public policy students were graduate students. And we taught a course in the Congress together. When I left Senator Biden's office in 1995, and I commute back and forth to Durham, which wasn't back then, before security, much longer commute than to Washington. So when I got out in 95, I said, I want to teach two courses, and my wife and I went, we lived down at Duke for the spring during the basketball season.
Yeah.
And I taught two classes, and it was fabulous. And the second course I taught was a course on the relationship between government and business, and that was for law students and MBAs. So half the class were law students, and half the class were MBAs at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke.
And what did you tell your students about the Congress and business?
Basically, I said that, and it wasn't just Congress; it was government business. We could talk about that for about. Any, after all, I taught, 13 classes or something like that, each one 2.5 hours long. So it covers a lot. But the thing I told them is there's a lot of very basic difference between government and business, and the biggest difference centers around the fact that business has real hard numbers you can use for goals and objectives. You can literally, when you decentralize, when we started decentralization, and DuPont was one of the first to do it, you decentralize everything except the finances. And what you essentially do is if you have six divisions, let's just take General Motors, because General Motors used the DuPont system. You basically go to someone and say, okay, you're running the Pontiac division. Tell you what, if you return every year, you have a return of X, and you have a market share of Y, and you have generating profits of Z, earnings of Z, we don't even have to talk to you because we know you're doing a good job. So you can run a very big, complex business pretty, not easily, but you have goals and objectives. The problem with government is we're talking about real soft, squishy objective issues. I mean, happiness, satisfaction, fairness. These are issues that you can't measure. The best example I can always give is it used to work a lot better 20 years ago when there were still people around who were there during the Vietnam War. But during the Vietnam War, the Secretary of Defense was McNamara. He was a Harvard Business School guy. He had the whiz kids. They were all Harvard Business School guys. And they ran Ford Company very, very successfully. And then they went to work, and he became Secretary of Defense. And during the Vietnam War. And what they came up with was the only way they could manage the Vietnam War day to day, since you couldn't even talk about land because it was a guerrilla war. And they came up with what everybody kind of made fun of, which was body count. Because the only thing they measured was body count, that's what they measured. And, in Vietnam, even in a war, trying to figure out when you're winning and when you're losing, when you're getting ahead and when you're not, what's a success and what isn't, what's a successful strategy even and what isn't. It's just so much more complicated than anything you'd ever run in the Ford Motor Company. And the Ford Motor Company is a very complex company to operate. So the basic difference is it's very, very difficult to manage, I think much more difficult to manage a government issue than it is to manage a... And that was the heart of it. And I talked about the different culture between government and business, and we talked about how the media interacts between government and business and the differences and all the rest of it. It's kind of interesting watching the presidential campaign, watching Mitt Romney kind of deal with the incredible differences there are between running a business and running a government.
Yeah, it certainly is. So you were teaching during the 2000s when there started to be a number of financial scandals like Enron, WorldCom. Obviously, you were probably still following politics. Do you recall having a strong reaction to the
scandals? Oh, yeah, I had a very, 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 very strong reaction to it. I didn't really study it. It was kind of like I was really more interested kind of in the politics. Now, the fact that I understood finance and the rest of it made the Enron thing just, how the hell did that ever happen? So it kind of deepened my criticism and my concern. But I never thought about, to be totally candid, how's the SEC handling this? How's it all gone? what should we be doing about it, how should we stop it again. That's not where where my interest was. I was not at all. I really wasn't doing a whole lot of investing at that point. I was investing, but I had people who were advising me on how to invest and what my portfolio should look like and things like that. And and let me explain that. I mean, the reason why I had this money is because my wife wasn't. I didn't make a whole lot of money, but my wife's grandfather was with Abbott Laboratories and one of the founders, and he was kind enough to, and then her parents, kind enough to give her Abbott stock. And if you want to go back and look at the stock, it really performed beautifully during the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. Abbott's was the one, so we accumulated quite a bit of money. So I was managing the money, but it wasn't the same as back when I was actually trading stocks and the rest of that. I like to think, I mean, we did very well, and I think probably that I can thank Wharton for that. But no, I was not. I was totally not focused on what was going on. I mean, I'd read some about the SEC or something like that. But
so you didn't have a sense of an impending catastrophe coming in the
financial crisis. I had no idea impending crisis, and I had no idea right up to literally when we had the meeting discussing what I was going to do with my 2 years in the Senate was going to be about finance. Now, the one area that I did target, that I was going to work on when we had our meetings to become a strategy, and that was trying to make sure that anybody who committed a crime went to jail. The whole financial fraud enforcement, that I was interested in that, and I was on the Judiciary Committee, and it turned out that I could play a major role in that.
Right. Yeah, I'll ask you about that here in a minute.
Sure.
Just a second. Now, you've spoken about this elsewhere, but tell me briefly how you came to be appointed to the Senate in 2008.
Yeah, what happened was I never thought I would run. I never thought I'd be a senator. People, you know, I had to do a whole lot of profiles because I was kind of an interesting person. I'm not interesting myself, but interesting, you know, taking over for the vice president and the rest of that. So, and people would say to me, well, did you ever dream? I mean, you're 22 years, you're on the staff. Didn't you sometimes sit in a hearing and say, you know, that should be me up there, or I would dream about being there? I can absolutely say with total, complete truth, I never once dreamed about being a United States Senator. Never once did I ever think about it. It was like, the example I always use is that is volleyball. There are great strikers and there are great setters. And good strikers don't usually make good setters, and good setters don't usually make good strikers. And I looked at myself as a setter. I thought I was really good at it. You know, I think most staff people wouldn't make good senators, but I think most senators wouldn't make good staff people. And with the exception of Senator Biden. So I never once thought about it. I never thought, because I never thought I knew I would never run for office. I'd never run for anything in my entire life. I never run for school board or school homeroom representative to the student council. I never, so I knew I wasn't going to run. So I never dreamed that or thought that I would be a United States Senator.
So when did you get the phone call?
Yeah, so you know, what happened was we were riding back. I was involved in the transition. One of the big things for me was being actually sitting with the vice president, with the president, with, you know, like eight, 10 people, and lay out the entire Obama administration starting right after the election. That was really a historic thing. So anyway, we were riding back from there. Riding back from a meeting in Chicago with the transition right after the election, and with the vice president elect and his son Hunter, who I've known for years, and if you think outside the world of. And we're riding back, and somehow the discussion always came around to, well, who's going to replace you? And there was a lot of speculation, and some people thought you would get it. And Hunter said, well, Ted, why don't you do it? And I said, oh, no, I'm not. This is the wrong time in my life. I can't do anything else. And the vice president-elect said, yeah, why don't you do it? And he said, look, think about it. I said, well, I'll think about it. He said, come back to me and tell me whether you want me to recommend you to the governor. And I thought about it for a few days. I talked it over with my wife, and we said, God, this, let's do it. Let's put his name in. So the vice president mentioned it to the governor. Now, the governor, I had been very close to the governor. The governor, Ruth Ann Miner, I always remember 1972. Remember I said I worked for the gubernatorial candidate? Uh-huh. Campbell, Sherman Tribbett? Well, when he got elected governor, his receptionist was Ruth Ann Miner. Not his secretary, his receptionist. And so I knew Ruth Ann back from 1972. I was on her strategy committee when she ran for governor. Used to meet regularly to figure out the strategy for the campaign, worked in the campaign. I was on her transition. So it's not like I knew Ruth Ann, and Ruth Ann and I had a wonderful relationship. So what happened is the vice president went to Ruth Ann, suggested me, and then my wife and I were preparing. We have a daughter and her husband and three wonderful kids that live in England, that have been born and raised in England. And so we were going to go Thanksgiving, bags full of, you know, turkeys and things like that to celebrate Thanksgiving because they don't celebrate any other time. And we're literally, this is the honest guy, with the bags packed, getting ready for the limo to come and pick us up, and telephone rings in my kitchen. I pick it up. It's Ruth Ann Miner. And Ruth Ann says, hey, Ted, this is Ruth Ann. I said, Governor. She said, I might as well tell you right off the bat, I want you to be my, I want to nominate you for Joe Biden's place. And be the Senate, United States Senator. I said, that's an incredible honor, Ruth Ann. And I'll do it. A little sidelight to it is that she said, one of the big differences that Vice President Biden always had, which I learned so much from him, I'm a planner. I like to lay out all my plans. It's like dominoes. I like to lay the dominoes out and then watch them all go down. Senator Biden, Vice President Biden, is someone that every minute of every day is figuring out, is this the best thing that I should be doing? He is constantly rearranging his life, and he's very good at it in terms of his highest and best use at that particular time. So I said to Ruth Ann, geez, Ruth Ann, I'm just getting ready to go to the airport to see my grandchildren. I'll be back. Can we do it a week from Monday? She said, sure, fine, that'd be fine. We can do it a week from Monday. I said, okay. I said, great, and I said, I'll be in touch. And so I hang up, and obviously the first person I call is the vice president-elect, and I say to him, I tell him what happened, and there's this silence on the other end of the line. And I said, Joe? He says, Ted. He said, do you really want this out there for 10 days to get screwed up? I mean, do you really want to take a chance that this whole thing is going to break in the press? You know, it's keeping this kind of thing as a secret. I said, you are absolutely, totally, completely right. It was like, you know, this is one, you know, he's done it to me and I've done him. I said, you are absolutely right. So I called Ruth Ann back and said, Ruth Ann, I'll do it on Monday. And so Lynn got on the airplane and went to England, and we didn't do it on Monday. Something came up, but I ended up doing it on Tuesday, and I had the press conference.
All right, so you already talked to me a little bit about some of your priorities. You said the judiciary, foreign relations, and I believe fraud, punishing fraud.
As part of judiciary, the financial part of what I was committed to do was going after financial fraud.
Okay.
And let me just have a minute, just a short time. What happened was, right after I got there, I went to Bruce Gordon, who was the Bruce Cohen. Correct that. It's Bruce Cohen. I went to Bruce Cohen and I said, Bruce, I want to get involved in this fraud thing. He says, well, he says, the chairman, Leahy, and Republican Grassley are working on a bill to increase the amount of money for FBI agents and prosecutors to go after that. And I said, great. I said, I'd really like to be a co-sponsor. He said, I'm sure that's no problem. So I went to see and I talked to Chairman Leahy, and Chairman said, sure, I'd love to have you on. I'd love to have you work on it. I said, well, look, I've been willing to, you know, this is something I really make a priority. I'm willing to go out there and work on this thing. And he said, great. He said, I'll write an op-ed. I'll go on to television shows and radio shows talking about it. I'll be active in the hearing. And he said, fine. So we had the first hearing, and there was Chairman Leahy and Chuck Grassley and me. And Leahy asked me to come up and sit right next to him, you know, because I was the lowest of the low, so I was all the way down at the end of the end of the row. So anyway, so he came up, and one of the people that testified was a guy named John Pestoli, and he was then Assistant Secretary in Justice. I can't remember. He went on to head up the TSA. And he gave the key testimony, and it goes back to your question earlier about the savings and loan crisis. He said during the savings and loan crisis, there were 1,000 FBI agents working on financial fraud. Now, there were 200 people working on financial fraud total. The reason was is because after 9/11, we transferred a whole bunch of FBI agents over to terrorism, and we hadn't replaced them. There were less financial fraud cases brought in 2007 than 2001. It's a really compelling testimony. So we, based on that and a bunch of other people said, we actually got a bill passed and to put additional, I think it's $150 million, $175 million mm-hmm. into just this area, financial fraud enforcement.
Yeah, this was the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act, right?
Yes. Okay. And the thing that was so amazing about it was, I don't know a freshman senator who's in the first 2 years ever going down to the White House for a bill signing and actually stood on the platform with the president and the rest. I mean, I've gone down to him when I was a freshman and sat in the audience. But because of that, thanks to Senator Chairman Leahy and Senator Grassley and the president, I actually went down to the bill signing. Was on the stage and with the president when he signed the bill. It was really, and I spent a lot of time after it doing oversight and the rest of that to make sure, to try to get it implemented.
Make sure that it was properly enforced, right? So this bill also authorized the creation of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
Right.
Was that something that you had pushed for? Or?
No, that was not. My main thing was not so much that. That was an important part of it because you got to find out what the crisis was. But no, my main emphasis was getting the prosecutors and the FBI agents to go after major Wall Street financial fraud.
Good. When you entered the Congress, were you concerned about short selling and the practice
no,
of short selling?
No, I never thought it would be of interest. I didn't enter with that. What happened was I got in and I don't know, it was February, I guess it was. I read about it and I read that what had happened is during the, I think it was 2008, the SEC had removed the uptick rule on short selling. Well, I'd done short selling when I was going through that investment phase, and it was an article of faith that one of the reasons that the way you control predatory bears, which are, you know, bears, stock market bears and bulls, people that basically bet on the market going down, the way you control predatory bears, one of the things you did is you had the uptick rule. The other thing is you required them to go out and borrow stock, any stock they were going to sell. Them to uptick rule is an article of faith. Now remember, there's nothing wrong with short selling. I've done short selling. Predatory bear short selling is where people drive down the price of a stock through many not really legitimate means. And they're called predatory bears. They've been around ever since we've had markets. And the uptick rule basically said that if you were selling a stock, you had to wait until it had an uptick. So if you back in the old days when we had eights, it was 20 and an eighth, and it went to 20, you couldn't sell. If it went 20 to 19 and 7/8, you can't sell. If it went from 19 and 7/8 to 20, then you could sell short. And you had to go out and borrow the money but to do it, and that was a way to control predatory shares. So I read it had been changed, and then I read that Mary Shapiro, in her hearing, had talked about she was probably going to reverse the, or gave the clear impression she was going to reverse the.
So there were already other senators that were aware of this issue?
No, there weren't any senators aware of it. No, Mary Shapiro was aware, but I didn't, there's no, the banking committee wasn't doing anything about it, I never heard anything about it. And I found out about it because as soon as I found out about it, I said, oh my God, we got to do something about it. So March 17th, I'll never forget, 2009, I sent a letter to Mary Shapiro and I said, look, I read your testimony and I really think you ought to reverse the uptick rule. And then I went out looking for senators to support it, and there weren't very many who knew anything about it, but I got to Johnny Isaacson and the senator from Georgia. I got
he was a Republican.
He's a Republican, absolutely. Yeah. I got him and Saxby Chambliss. Both of them were interested. They'd had a number of constituents contact them on this and how important it was. I got Orrin Hatch, and I got a bunch of folks that I got to know on the bank committee. I think John Tester. And others.
So this wasn't a partisan issue at all, or do you think?
No,
bipartisan
support? No. This had bipartisan. That's what I think I sent another letter. I think seven of us. Johnny Isaacson was the key Republican, and then we actually put in a bill to get it done because I was amazed that they weren't doing anything about it. And then I found out that the studies that had been done to do it were based on studies in the market during 2005. Well, you're not going to find that was a gigantic up market. You're not going to find short selling in an up market. So I got more and more incensed about the fact that they hadn't reversed the uptick rule. And then I found out that they changed the standard for holding the stock, borrowing the stock. I mean, if I go to sell short at my broker is Merrill Lynch says, okay, we'll borrow the shares, but you can't just sell. It's called naked short selling. You can't do naked short selling. You can't sell without it because then it's wide open. And then I found out And so they what they had done is the SEC had put in what's called a reasonable belief standard. All I had to do was say I had a reasonable belief I could get the stock. So when you go back and look at what happened during the Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers meltdown, you find that the float, that is how much, was over 100%. I mean, people were clearly trading, selling stock they didn't own in order to drive the stock price down. So I said, we got to do something about the short selling, the uptick rule, and we got to do something about the reasonable belief standard.
Hmm. Yep. So you wanted to see the uptick rule reinstated, but there are a number of technical problems with that. For instance, there were no longer these 1/8
yep.
Margins mm-hmm. since the decimalization of stock prices.
Right.
Were those the kind of reasons that the SEC gave?
No, the reasons the SEC gave is because we didn't do it. There were two Republicans on the SEC who said, we don't have to do any of this stuff. We voted for this stuff. And one of the Democrats had voted for this, and they just didn't. I mean, one of the things I think that we do way too much of in society today is we question other people's motives. Why they did vote the way they did, I don't know. Why Mary Shapiro didn't push through an uptick rule, I don't know. But none of the arguments that I heard convinced me that technically we can't do it. I mean, technically we can do anything. I mean, what we're doing now with the stock market, with the high frequency traders and algorithms and the rest of the stuff, the SEC can institute an uptick rule.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so let me talk a minute and talk about just the other one, which was the reasonable belief standard. There was a solution to that, and they never did that. And that was the DTCC, which is the clearinghouse for all trades. A group of the people that worked there came to me. I got the PowerPoint presentation. They made it to Johnny Isaacs and me. And they demonstrated that they could stop naked short selling very simply. And that is the way the thing works now is if I buy a stock, if the DTCC shows there's 200 shares of AT&T that they have, I can go in and borrow those 200 shares, know there's reasonable belief those 200 shares are there, and I can go out and sell AT&T short and say I have reasonable belief those 200 shares. You can come in right behind me and use the same 200 shares, and Sam and Mary and Jane all can come in and buy the same 200 shares. What the DTCC said is we're going to put a flag on that. So once one person uses those 200 shares, no one else can use those 200 shares.
Mm-hmm.
It was an elegant solution. It was a simple solution. It was a solution, and the SEC never moved forward on it. The DTCC went down and talked to them. They got no response, and when we had the roundtable on this, the DTCC never raised it. Because what the SEC did is they went back, and from everything I've heard, and energized the member firms of the DTCC that didn't want to do this. Next thing you know, the word came out clearly came out to the folks working at DTC, I don't want to hear this anymore. But I've got the PowerPoint presentation they give me. It lays out exactly what was happening. They went and talked to the SEC, and the SEC never moved forward.
That's quite interesting.
Very discouraging.
Yep. So in April 2010, the SEC did adopt a couple of amendments to Regulation SHO, which is the regulation that concerns this practice of short selling and naked short selling. And it restricted short selling in instances where a company's share drops 10% or more in value in one day.
Yeah.
Was that a satisfactory solution
for
you?
No, not even close.
Nope.
Just not even close. I mean, you got to know there has to be something that it works a hell of a lot better than 10%. To reduce the shares. They can do 10% a day. I mean, during the Lehman Brothers Bear Stearns, you can just keep banging away at this stock. And there's a simple solution out there. First off, there's a simple solution to have the uptick rule, and a simple solution in terms of getting rid of the reasonable belief standard. So the reasonable belief standard would really be extraordinarily easy to do. If they're really concerned about it, that's what they do. What they're doing is they're compromising. And this goes back to they're compromising because they are responding, in my opinion, just on watching them closely, good people, but they're responding to the overwhelming percentage of folks contacting them who are from Wall Street and do not want things to change. And we can get into that later on and why that is, but mm-hmm. clearly they're just not, the SEC is not operating what's best for the markets. They are trying to, again, good people, they're trying to compromise between the vast majority of contacts they have and contacts not just from folks on Wall Street, but also people that used to work at the SEC. and what they think is the right thing to do.
Did you also feel that the SEC should have been more aggressive in bringing actions against enforcement actions against people that were doing naked short selling?
Absolutely. I don't know what the rules are, but there was plenty of anecdotal evidence around about not only what went on during Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, but also who was involved in what went on during Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. So clearly, enforcement division. The main enforcement division, the main enforcement thing I worked on with Rob Kazami, who's the head, and I had two oversight hearings on it, was the financial fraud with regard to the securitization of the mortgages, which and what went on with compensation and the rating agencies and those things that went on with regard to the housing.
Tell me a little bit more about that. What did you find out in those hearings?
Well, first of all, we had the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. I recommend that everybody. There were 4 days of hearings. Carl Levin. What had happened to me was I sit down on one of two committees. Most senators have more than one two committees, but when Vice President Biden was senator, we found the two committees was more than enough to keep me busy, and it was more than enough. Senator, when Scott Brown won the seat in Massachusetts, they have to reorganize the committees. So the chairman, the majority leader, Harry Reid, came to me and said, staff person said, hey, would you join the Armed Services Committee? So I said, sure, I'll join the Armed Services Committee. And then I saw Carl Levin came to me and said, I'd like you to move on to Homeland Security because we have the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. I said, Carl, I just said I was going to be in Armed Services. The reason I did was to be with you. So make a long story not so long. Right after that, I'm on the floor, and Harry Reid comes up to me with kind of a grin, and he says, Ted, you know, I asked you to be on, or you were asked to be on Armed Services, and you said yes. And I said, that's right. He said, okay, I'd like you to be on Homeland Security, too. And I said, Mr. Leader, I mean, four big committees like that. He said, and he's got his smile. And my basic rule was to say yes. And
right.
So I said yes, and I got on the committee. The reason I wanted to get on that committee was because of the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, led by Carl Levin with co-chair Senator Coburn from...
And you had a whole hearings into a number of different...
We had 4 days of hearings. We talked. We met on rating agencies. We worked on Washington Mutual.
Right.
We went on Goldman Sachs. Anyway, those three.
Which do you think was the most, I guess, penetrating or found out the most?
I think all three of them. It was they were penetrating, and I think if you look at them, you just got to believe that. I remember when we were doing Washington Mutual. Washington Mutual had something like 9% of their regular loans were stated income loans, LIR loans. And something like 60% were state income loans. That's where you come in and you say, I make $500,000 a year. They don't ask you for a W-2. They don't ask you anything. They just take you for $500,000
right.
a year. Widespread, especially in these states. And even on the sub, can you believe this? On the subprime loans, over 50% of loans. When we asked the head of the Thrift Supervision Organization what he thought about, Carl Levin asked him, he said, that's anathema to banking. And then I asked him, I said, did you know about these? He said, no, I didn't know. It's state income loans. I didn't know that was going on.
Yeah.
And that the Inspector General for the Treasury Department said this was a target-rich environment for fraud. That was all sent over to the SEC and the Justice Department.
On that committee, did you consider looking more into the government-sponsored entities like Fannie and Freddie?
By the way, Fannie and Freddie should have been looked into and should have been part of Dodd-Frank. I absolutely totally believe that. And clearly, there would have been space on the Permanent Subcommittee Investigations to look at that. But there are plenty of agencies. They're government agencies. There are plenty of committees looking at those. The Permanent Subcommittee Investigations, putting one of these hearings together is incredible. No one really was looking into what happened on Wall Street, what happened in the market brokerage industry, what happened with the banks. And so I think Chairman Levin thought that should be his thing. But no, what went on at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was deplorable.
Mm-hmm. Stop it. Okay, another issue that you were interested in during this period was high-frequency trading. How did you get interested in that issue?
Yeah, it was not. I never thought about it. I didn't know anything about it. I kind of knew in the back of my mind that we'd gone from, you know, eighths to digitalization and the rest of that stuff. What happened was when I started getting into the uptick rule and especially the reasonable belief standard and DTCC and trying to get rid of naked short selling. And the uptick rule is I was getting pushback. And in Washington, I was getting pushback. Nobody, by the way, nobody was really very successful at lobbying Congress on this issue. Mm-hmm. But they started saying, well, you know, this would be very difficult. It's kind of in one of your questions. This would be very if we did implement the uptick rule, and especially if we had a real standard for selling short. This would make life for high-frequency traders very complicated. Well, I really didn't know what high-frequency traders were. And basically, there are folks that use algorithms to trade thousands of shares in a second that come on after we move to digitalization. And in fact, they had started a lobbying group, which I said, I'm helping employment. They're actually going to be a high-frequency trading lobbying group to fight, you know, the changes in the short selling. So I got more involved with them. And at that time, TAB, which is a very authoritative group, said something like 70% of all trades were high-frequency trading. They didn't, you know, nobody really knows to this day. Oh, the people that are doing it know it, but the SEC or anyone else doesn't really know how these folks function in the market. And I'm not just talking about what their algorithms are that determine what their strategies are. No one knows kind of...
what impact they're having?
No, nobody knows. Nobody knows what impact they're having. I mean, people say there's more liquidity, but nobody knows the mechanics of what's actually going on. In the old days, you know, when it was an eighth, every single trade went across. You know who made the trade, you know when it was made, you know who was the broker, you know all that kind of information. That information is not available on these high-frequency trades. I mean, right now, on those thousands and thousands and thousands of trades, to this day, 90% of the trades are canceled before they're executed, before they're consummated. We don't know why. And that was one of the things we're going to talk about a little later. But clearly, we had a major change. The basic argument I made, and maybe it's an engineering argument, is that we've had this incredible change in the market. 70%, we went from 0 to 70% of our trades being high-frequency trading. We have no transparency. We don't know what's going on in those markets. We don't know what each individual trade. I mean, when we had the flash crash in May 6th, which we'll talk about later, it took us 5 months to find out what happened. Well, it wouldn't take us 5 months to find out what happened, you know, 10 years, 15 years ago. Because we don't have the data. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of data, but we don't have it organized in such a way, what they call a consolidated audit trail, which is what we really need.
Okay.
So
just to ask you, how specifically did this issue come to your attention? Was it a news article? Did someone come to you and say that this?
No, people through staff and others, who's pushing back against the change in the uptick rule?
Okay.
And that's literally how it was. It was clearly kind of there. People who are the main people that are upset about this uptick rule thing, mm-hmm. And who's lobbying the SEC, and you know, just asking people, you know, your staff person, you know, what's the problem here? Uh-huh. And the problem was the high-frequency traders did not want this now.
Right. So you worked at the SEC to look into this issue. What specifically did you want them to do?
Well, I sent him a couple of letters. I sent one in, I think it was August of 2009, where I said, this was before the flash crash, where I said, look, we've had this incredible amount of change. There's a lot of money involved. The thing I said earlier, you know, we don't know what's going on. We don't have transparency. If you don't have transparency, you can't have regulation. You're not regulating these markets. So, you know, we've got to get in there and find out to regulate this market. This is before the flash crash. At the same time, I was talking about the whole market structure issue, which is the fact that we had gone from basically two exchanges that were regulated exchanges to like 50 different venues now, dark pools. Dark pools is a great name. I love it because it's really true. It's dark. We don't know what's going on. We have lost the ability to regulate these markets is mm-hmm. what my basic argument was. We've lost it through high-frequency trading. We've lost it through Mark. So I wrote in 2009, laid out a concern about market structure and those issues.
This was in August 2009, right?
August 2009, right.
And I think your letter said that you requested the SEC undertake a comprehensive, independent, zero-based regulatory review of a broad range of issues.
Right. And that's really, you know, basically what I'm saying is, which any business would do, and most government organizations I do, we have what's called zero-based budgeting. Mm-hmm. You just go back and you look at this thing, okay, let's just start from scratch. Let's cut out all the undergrowth, and let's find out what's happening here. And because that has not been done, what basically has happened is this is it's, the example I use is kind of it's like a bush in your front yard. High-frequency trading and market structure have been allowed to grow completely untrimmed for years. And, you know, you can't get it by just trimming a few pieces off the edge. You got to go back into the bush and start all over again from scratch and say, okay, if I were designing this, how would I do it? Now, maybe these changes you can't make, but what's the right way to proceed in these things? So that's what I asked for, and I laid details on what I thought they should pursue.
Did you try to get other senators to join you in this letter?
No. Well, I did. No, I really didn't. This issue is... you got to understand, and you don't got to understand... the Senate, the Congress, the federal government is dealing with gazillions of incredibly complex issues of varying degrees of understanding. I mean, just I can remember, I'll just give an example because it's really key. When I got on the Homeland Security Committee, I've been working in the Senate for 22 years. I'm an engineer. I got an MBA from the Wharton School. You know, I know a lot about a lot of things. And so I went to my first Homeland Security Committee, and Joe Lieberman is the chair, and Susan Collins is a ranking member, and they were dealing with some issue, I don't remember what it was, about how government functions. That's what Homeland Security used to do before it was Homeland Security, it was called Government Operations. So they were dealing with some esoteric piece of government that's very, very important. First half an hour, I didn't understand 20 minutes of what they were talking about. So you get these very, very complex issues. And members of Congress, what they do is essentially, as I said, Woodrow Wilson said, committee of Congress is committee at work. Congress committee is Congress work. You specialize in certain areas. So what you have to do is make a basic decision that I'm going to make the best of the time it is to understand hybrids of trading. And I got some people to kind of buy into that.
But so they had to cut. These staff members or these outside
senators? No, senators.
Okay.
The staff members have become involved. Mm-hmm. They didn't know what's going on. Carl Levin clearly knew what's going on. Turned out Mark Warner, who's on the bank committee and interested in these issues, got involved in it. But no, when I started, this was totally between me and the Securities Exchange Commission.
Right. And how do they react to this request that they undertake a review of the market structure?
They were very welcoming. You know, the chair spoke positively about that this was going to happen. In fact, every one of my proposals to the SEC got a very positive response in mm-hmm. terms of going to do it. The problem is not much was done.
Right. Now, you mentioned dark pools earlier. Obviously, sure. dark pools are closely related to this issue of high-frequency trading. How did you get interested in those?
I started figuring out how do high-frequency trading work. I was also interested, you could see with the change, the digitalization, and the impact that it had on the uptick rule, or proposed to happen the uptick rule, it just was one of a piece. I mean, you just mm-hmm. looked at it, it was like a gigantic market structure. High-frequency trading was not a problem by itself. It was part of a bigger problem, which was the change in the structure of the markets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've not talked about it, but what had happened was during the Bush administration, and this is not going to be a partisan political screed on the Bush administration, I think it's fair to believe that if you, and it's still alive and well, I mean, if you listen to what Mitt Romney says today, that the one of the differences between Republicans and Democrats is that the Republicans basically think that we should have a laissez-faire, no regulations, lack of regulation, not no regulations, not very many regulations, that regulations are what ruin everything and we shouldn't have regulation. Well, what they did on the SEC when they came in is they did away with regulations, and that's, you know, Bernie Madoff. I mean, basically made it very difficult to prosecute a case All members of the Securities Exchange Commission had to sign off on it. Bernie Madoff was clearly that what was going on, but they didn't do it. And one of the problems I see about regulation is, I'm not for regulation, I'm not for over-regulation, but I think it's important to have regulation. It's just like a football game. You know, if you basically have a football game and they go out there and say, well, you know, the referees are just stopping the play of game and the flow, let's eliminate the referees. Well, you know, the first or second pileup, maybe the third, but third pileup, it's not a pileup you want to be in. Mm-hmm. The same way with the police. I mean, the police on the ground, you know, people say, well, you know, it doesn't work. Well, you know, that's like saying there's crime in a city. You're not going to send the police in because they're not going to solve crime. They're clearly not going to solve crime. But you're going to solve the person that breaks the window and grabs the money and runs or just beats them up on the street. Same thing applies to regulation. Basically, what happened, and Christopher Cox, even who was the chair at the time and afterwards, said, it's clear that voluntary regulation really didn't work. And that's essentially what we had. We had voluntary regulation. They removed the rules and just things just spiraled out of control.
Yeah. When you were looking to some of these complex issues like dark pools, did you have contacts with some of the companies involved, like Direct Edge, BATS, NASDAQ?
Oh, yeah. No, I used to go up to New York regularly. I meet with one of the things I did when I was on the Broadcasting Board of Governors is oversees all U.S. international broadcasts. I travel around the world. One of the best things I do when I arrive in a new country would be to meet with the American reporters from Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, and they'd be almost as good as the ambassador and the other place, the CIA, about what's going on in the country. And so what I did with the Wall Street thing is I'd go up to New York regularly and meet with, you know, Gretchen Morgenstern, I met with Andrew West Sorkin, a whole bunch of folks, and say, what do you think's going on? What do you think's happening with hybrid streaming? What do you think's going on with these things? And I went and talked to the people at the exchanges. I talked to a lot of people in the brokerage business, the agents, traders. I just surrounded this issue and talked to people about what's going on. So most of my comments you'll find are based on having talked to people. People would, and one thing I found out about Wall Street was nobody wants. It's just like doctors and lawyers and senators. Nobody wants to rat anybody out. Only they are extreme. I used to say you have to take T-shirts up there. You know the no snitch T-shirts that are popular in the ghetto, where not in the ghetto in certain parts of the city where people say, you know, you shouldn't snitch, you shouldn't tell. Well, that's Wall Street's got that cue. Loads of people would tell me off the record what was going on, but they wouldn't say it on the record. I had the number two person in one of our major banks in my office when I was started on the uptick rule, and we were talking about something, and then he said, we got ready to leave. He said, by the way, he said, what you're doing on the uptick rule is absolutely right. You know, you really keep at it. I said, can I quote you? He said, oh, no, can't quote me. He said, they'll come after me. That's the honest God truth. They'll come after me. Mm-hmm. And I said, so that's it. So there's a no-snitch rule. So I got lots of information. I got people come to me. There's all kinds of allegations. You'll never hear me really make allegations about the high-frequency traders are doing. I've heard all kinds of allegations about what's going on. But we can't test any of these things. It's supposed to be based on trust. Well, you know, trust us. Trust is not something when you're handling what I consider to be one of the most valuable things the United States has, and that's the credibility of our markets.
Right. Okay, so we've talked about high-frequency trading, dark pools, right. A number of other issues. Let's talk about the flash crash.
Sure.
Right. So obviously, there had been attention paid to this issue of high-frequency trading prior to the flash crash. Mm-hmm. Do you remember when you heard about the flash crash?
Yeah. What's your reaction? Oh, yeah. No, I was literally presiding over the Senate, and
this was on May 6th, 2010.
Yeah. I was presiding over the Senate. And I think it's when I came down off of the presiding, my chief of staff was there and said, there's been a flash crash in the market.
Right. Yeah. And so both the House and the Senate held hearings on the issue, right? Or it might have just been the House.
Yeah, I think
okay,
it's
could,
the House.
Okay, could have been wrong about that.
Yeah.
When did you finally get a satisfactory answer to what caused the flash crash?
I still don't.
Okay.
Not to this day, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at the answers that they gave, there is no kind of real analysis of what happened, because we don't have the information in order to make that analysis. That, again, took 5 months, and they came up with an answer, but there's still plenty of credible people out there saying that's not true, that's not what happened. And without the contemporaneous analysis of what went on, we don't have a black box. You know, even airlines, they have a black box, right? And the black box is a crash, and then they pull the black box. It still takes some time to work it out. But there's no contemporaneous, really, gathering of the data in an organized way in a consolidated audit trail that would tell us what happened.
All right, let's talk about the Dodd-Frank Act a little bit. Was it obvious from the time that you entered the Senate that there was going to be a major financial reform bill like Dodd-Frank?
Yeah.
Okay. What were your goals for the bill?
My goals, the number one goal that I had and everybody in America had, was to end Too Big to Fail. Essentially, everybody agreed that what we had to do is we never again could the American taxpayer be forced to bail out a bank because it was too big. That was just it. That's the thing. So that number one thing was Too Big to Fail.
Okay. So were there any thoughts in your mind of restoring the divisions of Glass-Steagall?
Absolutely. So the first thing is Too Big to Fail. Second thing is that banks were engaged in way too risky behavior. And commercial banks. Basically, the people that were FDIC insured should not be engaged in credit default swaps and the deals that went on. So the second thing was, first thing was the banks too big, and Too Big to Fail, which is essentially first not too big and not going to fail. So there's two pieces to it, but basically Too Big to Fail. The second thing is, on the too fail thing, is we need to get banks back to what they were when they were commercial banks, investment banks. Commercial banks were basically low risk, low return people. The PCORA Commission in the 1930s had established the Glass-Steagall Act and said that if you want to be a commercial bank, you would get FDIC insurance. That's the way we stop bank runs, which have been a problem for this ever since the founding of the Republic. So we'd have to FDIC insurance. And then if you wanted to really invest in risky things and be a bank, you'd be an investment bank. And that worked for us for 60 years until the 90s, when Alan Greenspan and at the Fed kind of started taking it apart. And then in 1999, we passed the Graham Leach Bliley Amendment, which did away with Glass-Steagall. And so my basic approach was, look, guys, they worked for us for all these years. The banks were engaged in risky behavior. The fact that they have FDIC insured investments allow them to have a portfolio that's even more risky. We should go back to Glass-Steagall. So the first thing, Too Big to Fail. Second thing was Glass-Steagall. And third, we had to do something about the derivatives. That we did again. The other thing we'd done, which was outrageous, was the Commodities Future Modernization Act, which has said the federal government could not even look at derivatives. So those are the three things. Now, in conjunction with that, one of the things that's especially relevant to what we're talking about here today is I wanted us to write the laws like we did with the PCORA Commission and Glass-Steagall. I wanted the Congress to actually legislate on this issue, not kick it back to the regulators, which is what happened. And there were a number of reasons why I didn't want to kick it back to the regulators. First was that the regulators have been the cause of most of the problems, in my opinion, the lack of regulation. So, okay, we got new regulators. Well, okay, so let's just say we do have new regulators. New president comes in. Republican president says we don't need regulation anymore, and regulators are out again. I mean, right now we're running a presidential campaign. Mitt Romney does not think we should have regulation. I guarantee if he gets elected president, and not because he's a bad person, or not because he's under the influence of Wall Street or anything like that, but he just basically believes we shouldn't have any regulation. So my basic thing was, look, let's make the laws like we did with the PCORA Commission, like we did with Glass-Steagall, and let's implement the laws, number one. Number two is, If we send all these regulations back to the regulatory agencies, they're going to be frozen. I mean, there's no way that these regulatory agencies. I mean, we have so many changes that are going on. For instance, high frequency trading wasn't even in Dodd-Frank, and clearly was going to. And market structure was clearly not in Dodd-Frank. So the SEC, for example, is trying to deal with market structure. They're starting to deal with high frequency trading, and now you're going to take all these other issues and just throw them back on them for rulemaking. Mm-hmm. I mean, they it can't work. So the other thing with regard to regulation was we've got to pass a law that is a bright line law that makes the law clear. Then the regulators can regulate. Regulators are great at regulating. It's really important to regulate. They should not be writing the law.
All right. So you mentioned three goals that you have for the bill. Let's take them one by one. The first one you talked about was restoring the divisions of Glass-Steagall.
Right.
Was that a non-starter in the Congress,
yes,
or did you have
that was a non-starter. Maria Campbell, Senator Maria Campbell, and John McCain, bipartisan. I sponsored a bill with them to reinstate Glass-Steagall, but it was clear from the beginning that when you start out with the basic premise that the Republicans were really not going to vote for anything, then all you need is 3, 4, 5 Democrats who say, this is too complicated, let's give it to the regulators. That's essentially what happened.
Okay. Did the White House express an opinion on it?
Oh, yeah. White House was right in with the Timothy Geithner, representing the president, fought a number of these proposals. Mm-hmm. Secretary Geithner's approach was, we need to give it to the regulators.
Mm-hmm. And second, you talked about any too big to fail. As I understand it, the way that you wanted to do this is basically to sort of cap the size of the bank by limiting the amount of liabilities that they could take on. Is that correct?
Liabilities. I also wanted the capital. There was a bill, Brown-Kaufman, it was called an amendment. Mm-hmm. It would have skinny down the banks. It would have limited what their liabilities, what their assets are as total gross domestic product.
And then there's also another act called the Safe Banking Act.
That's the one.
Right. Okay, is that the same thing as
the same thing. Yeah, Brown-Kaufman Amendment was the Safe Banking Act. It was Sherrod Brown and I sponsored it, and it would have, and it was one of the big votes on the bill. We only ended up getting 33 votes, and the big reason is that we only got like three Republicans. And then what happened is the chairman of the bank committee, Chris Dodd, decided that he did not want that in the bill. He thought that might hurt his chances of passing. Mm-hmm. And Timothy Geithner and the Treasury Department and the administration fought the amendment. There's a great quote by a senior Treasury official said afterwards, if we wanted Brown-Kaufman to pass, it would have passed.
Right. And the third thing that you mentioned was derivatives.
Yes.
Was there did you make an effort to get that included?
Yeah, that was not. I wanted to have that included. The main player on that was Blanche Lincoln, the senator from Arkansas. She had an amendment. We went back and forth on that. Essentially, we ended up with a pretty good thing. But again, it was totally in the hands of the regulators. And I mean, I learned a fact that was absolutely a perfect example. And this is since SJSC. The entire department at the SEC dealing with derivatives consists of 14 people. Derivatives is like a massive, incredibly complicated issue. We didn't, again, the law laid out some good things, but eventually pitched it back to the regulators to have to come up with the rules. They came up with the rules, CFTC and the SEC came out way late on the rules.
So what is your final verdict on Dodd-Frank? Is it an improvement overall?
That's a very difficult question. I had a very difficult time voting for it when it came back from the Conference Committee. There's the Consumer Finance Protection Board. I think that's a really good thing. I think there were some really good things. The Risk Assessment Commission Committee, it could be a good thing. There are lots of things that were good on it, but I think to look at it, on the number one issue in the American people's minds and in members of the Congress, if you go back and listen to the debate on the floor by members of Congress on the single thing they wanted more than anything else, it was to eliminate too big to fail. And there is absolutely, totally, completely clear any objective analysis of where we are today. I mean, Sandy Weill came out and said we ought to go to Glass-Steagall. I mean, this is the guy who he's the guy that led the charge to eliminate Glass-Steagall. There's no doubt that our banks are still too big to fail. And as Alan Greenspan said, too big to fail.
So on October 1st, 2010, you were appointed to the Congressional Oversight Panel for TARP, replacing Elizabeth Warren. Right. Can you tell me about the circumstances that are around this?
Sure. Department? It's real simple. It's just like I told the story earlier about Harry Reid called me and asked me to go on Armed Services and Homeland Security. The majority leader called me. He said, Ted, I want you to serve on the Congressional Oversight Panel. And I said, sure. I mean, essentially, it was, I really, I trusted Harry, and Harry was looking out for me, and it was a good thing. And I read what it was, and I have to think the world of Elizabeth Warren. And I really, obviously, am concerned about the TARP and the oversight of the TARP. So when he asked me to do it, I said fine.
And you were the chairman of the panel, is that correct?
Exactly. No. What happened was he appointed me. Yes, I was, but he appointed me to the panel. He appointed me to the panel to face Elizabeth Warren, and gosh, I don't know. Like 2 or 3 days after it was in, the Republican Democratic members both voted that I be the chair. It was great. It was really a great positive affirmation of, first off, how bipartisan, what a good job Elizabeth Warren had done, and the Republicans on the panel had done in making it a bipartisan panel. And then it was nice that they thought I could do it.
Did it feel different being the chair of that panel rather than being just an individual senator? In other words, did you feel like you needed to take a perhaps more neutral position on issues, or did you?
No, that's not really the way the Senate. I don't think that's the way the Senate works. I mean, you can have it from time to time, especially in early. You know, if you're writing legislation, it's always good if you're the chair. But most of the legislation is written by the chair, so. No, I felt very, it was really interesting. I mean, I can't think of anything I would have done that would have been felt more comfortable, because clearly I chaired hearings in the Judiciary Committee, oversight hearings in the Judiciary Committee. I've been involved in the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations on Oversight. I've been involved on the Foreign Relations Committee and to some extent Armed Services. So I understood about oversight. I understood how it worked. They were in the same building, the same rooms, the same format. It was really... a lot of people thought I was still in the, you know, even I served as chairman after I left the Senate. People thought I was still in the Senate because I was chairing these committees. So it was one of the easiest things to do. And the one thing I would say is the one thing I was very, very concerned about, I'd had a wonderful staff when I was Senator Biden's chief of staff. And then I had a wonderful staff when I was senator. I'm not just saying that. I mean, if you look at what I was able to accomplish in 2 years, it was a great staff. And, the Congressional Oversight Panel staff all existed. So I went over with their kind of like, oh my goodness, I've been used to a really, really good staff, and here I step in this very complex issue. And it turned out that Elizabeth Warren done a wonderful job. The head of the staff was a woman named Naomi Baum. She did a great job. The staff, Thomas C., who was the communications director, just a great group.
Did you have any specific goals while you were chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel, or were you just...
Yeah, trying to find out what really went on with the TARP, trying to make sure that the last months of the TARP, that we did something about it. I was especially concerned about the housing issue, which was, nothing. It really had been very poorly handled by the Treasury Department. The mortgage modification program just had, it was supposed to spend $50 million. It spent like, I don't know what, $1 billion by the time I left. It was supposed to modify some incredible number of mortgages, like 3 or 4 million, something like that, and hadn't modified near enough. And now the objective even changed from modifying mortgages to just trying to pass mortgages. So it was a pretty sad tale in terms of the...
Right. And there are, of course, extensive records of the panel's activity, so I won't go into too much detail about that. But just in retrospect, would you characterize the TARP program as a success or a failure?
Well, that's a good question. I think in terms of the fact that the one test that you have, which is did they spend... I mean, originally we talked about $700 billion for TARP. It looks like it's going to cost like $25 billion. Surely after $700 billion, it got down to, I think, that the appropriation was... thought about was there didn't need to really be an appropriation the way it was set up, $350 billion, something like that. But so clearly, it was much, 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 much less than in terms of the cost. Damon Silvers, who was my vice chair, made some very articulate arguments. I'd recommend that to anybody who's interested on, what we didn't do with that money. Maybe we should have spent more, for instance, in the housing area especially. Maybe we should have spent more money, and it would have been a real benefit to the taxpayer in terms of reducing the cost to the American people of there is a cost of inaction. So I think in terms of we didn't spend anywhere near what we should, so you got to give them high marks for that.
So I understand that while you were in the Senate, every week you'd go down to the Senate floor and speak about a particular federal employee. Yeah. Would you mind telling me about that?
Sure. One of the great things, a lot of great things about being a senator, but one of the really great things was for many years I had been upset the way in the public discourse and elected officials and public officials had done critical of federal employees. My experience with federal employees at working in the Senate, working at the Broadcasting Board of Governors in general, is that they are incredibly competent, hardworking, dedicated people. I remember when I was at Wharton, there was a monograph that our business school put out where they compared the educational background of federal employees versus corporate employees at middle and upper management, and they were exactly the same. And that's what I found. I found so many great federal employees. So I'd had this kind of, I say one of the great things about being a senator is you can, if you have an itch, you can scratch it. So I decided early on that I was going to recognize different federal employees, not necessarily all the Nobel laureates and all the, the great, clear, successful federal employees of which we all know, but everything from the very top to the, throughout the federal system. And so I talked about an administrative assistant or secretary for someone, and I talked about, so I went around to, I went to everyone, just about every agency. I ended up recognizing 100 federal employees. I did it just about every week. I recognized the Securities Exchange Commission. I recognized an employee of the Securities Exchange Commission, a group really led by who had done a great job in the Enforcement Division. And in it, I talked about the people of the Securities Exchange Commission and what high regard I had for them and the fact that they were dedicated people who were doing it for the right reason. In my experience, may have differences of opinion about strategy and things like that, but how great they were. And I talked about the quote on the building, the Securities Exchange Commission. And one of the great things that happened to me, really great things, was I guess about after I've been out of the Senate for like a year and a half, the market abuse unit of the Securities Exchange Commission, which had been set up after the market meltdown, invited me to come back and talk about my experiences. And they were there in the SEC building, and then they had a webcam, they had a web set up so that anybody in the SEC could, in the building, or anywhere, any SEC office anywhere, could turn it on and listen to what I had to say. And in the introduction, the head of the unit talked about the August, I think it's 9th, 2010, letter I sent about the flash crash, where I talked about market structure and how we should do something market structure. And he said that letter was their roadmap that they used for what it is they were doing. And so I'd finally like to thank my staff. I mean, and they just didn't say me, they said my staff. Jeff Cotton was my chief of staff, and John Nolan, who came over, and Josh Goldstein, who was just there working while I went back to law school, and Jane Woodfin, who was my legislative director. Just an extraordinary group of individuals in Washington and in Wilmington who had done most had done an incredible job for Senator Biden and ended up doing an incredible job for me. And to the extent that anything I have to say and hear about the SEC or anything else is wrong, that's me. If it was right, I guarantee it was my staff.
Well, no man is an island.
Yeah.
Senator, before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask you just briefly what you've been up to since leaving the Senate.
Sure. I continue to teach at the Duke Law School. Mm-hmm. There's a program that Dean Levy, who's the new dean, he's not new now, he's been there for 5 years. When he first came to law school, he said, I want to raise the profile of Duke Law School in D.C. So he asked Chris Schrader and me, who teaches with me, if we would do a course in Washington. And what happened is literally students, we've done this for the last few years, students take off, usually it's the third, spring of their third semester in law school, third year in law school. And they take a job in Washington working in the federal government or something in line with the federal government. And then once a week, we teach a course. Jeff Pex helped us, who we've known, who worked with us on the Borg nomination. We do a course on federal policy. So I'm doing that. That's an important part of what I'm doing. I'm writing a column. I mean, I never thought I'd do this. I'm writing a column every week in the Sunday edition of the Gannett newspaper here in Delaware called the News Journal, which I am, very much enjoying. I just stepped down as the co-chair of the STEM Council in Delaware, Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math Education Council in Delaware, where we had 26 Delawareans from education and business and higher education and came up with a plan for how we can improve the quality of STEM education in Delaware. I'm on some social service boards, the Children, Families, and First, and the Ministry of Caring. I'm enjoying my grandchildren, and I'm involved helping Vice President Biden whenever he should call and ask for any help. So it's a good life.
Sounds like a full schedule. Though.
Yes, it is. Okay.
Well, Senator Kaufman, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I just want to tell you, I thank you for doing this. I think the issues we talked about are key. Let me just say one thing, because the real reason I'm involved in this is because I actually believe that the two most important institutions that made America great are our democracy, the crown jewels, our democracy, and our free and credible markets. If something happens to change those two things, it really, really hurts us and hurts our children and grandchildren. Credibility of markets are under attack. We had a tough time with the dot-com meltdown. We had a difficult time with this financial meltdown. I think that the concerns about high-frequency trading, really knowledgeable people are concerned traders are not people, the average retail investor is not being treated fairly. If we mess up our markets, it's more difficult for us to have IPOs. There's a wonderful thing by an author called Grant Thurman laid out what's going on with the IPO business, why high frequency trading is done, and market structure problems. I just think it isn't just key to finance, it's key to our entire country. I think the SEC stands as an incredibly important part of this, and I think that I fought from the very beginning for greater funding for the Securities Exchange Commission. They're a great group of individuals down there. One of the problems is they just don't have enough people to do all the different jobs. The Securities Exchange Commission is incredibly important because it along with this Commodities Future Trading Commission, looks after our markets, and as I said, the markets are the crown jewels, along with democracy, one of the two crown jewels of our society. So I wish nothing but the best for the Securities Exchange Commission, that stronger, better operating Securities Exchange Commission with the dedicated people that work there is essential for the future of the United States, not just the financial future, but the entire future of the United States.
Well, that's a good thought to end on. Senator Ted Kaufman, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.